Okay, master of ceremonies to Phil.
Okay, the Metta Sutta, the Buddha's words on loving kindness. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, nor despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be a sublime abiding, I am holding to false views, a pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Okay. So whatever your meditation subject is, just focus on that. Calm the mind down. Be mindful of your meditation subject. If your mind drifts, just bring it back. Then as you listen, if you keep up with your meditation subject as you listen, you'll find that your mind will become calmer and calmer as the time goes by, because Dhamma has that effect. When you listen to Dhamma, that is one of the benefits. It makes the mind calm. But you have to have a mind that's receptive to that. And that's why when listening, it should be a meditation subject. So, now that we're ready to receive Dhamma, I think I'll reflect. Just then, we saw Tola paying her respects. And we do that out of faith, if one is a practicing Buddhist. If one practices meditation for the purpose of developing the path to enlightenment, then faith is a very important factor. If one's only practicing meditation just to be calm, with no particular religious reason for it, a sort of secular meditation practice, if you would, then that's fine too, nothing wrong with that. But then obviously faith has much less of a role to play. But nevertheless, even if you're practicing for secular purposes, faith is still a factor. Because if you don't have faith in the meditation technique that you're using, then you'll always have doubt. And if you have doubt, then you have distraction. The mind won't become concentrated. And so you really defeat the purpose of practicing. You end up sitting there for no good reason, and at best daydreaming. So some faith is required if you're going to practice meditation for whatever reason, but particularly from a Buddhist perspective, faith is one of the five powers, which we call in Pali the five bala or indriya. And when you see people prostrate themselves in front of a Buddha image, it's easy to misunderstand. From an outsider looking on, it's easy to misunderstand why Buddhists do that. When I was a teenager, and I'd only just come into contact with Buddhism, I had to sit an English exam for qualifications, GCE or whatever it was, I can't remember now. And one of the things for the English exam was you had to write an essay and then give an oral presentation to two examiners. And I chose to write an essay about religion and war and why, despite claiming to be religious, many people go to war. Some, even of the same religion, praying to the same God. So I mounted an argument, and I had to look at all the religions through history. And when I got to do the oral presentation, there were two teachers there who were adjudicating. One I knew and was my English teacher, and the other was from another school. And I'd gone through a lot of the presentation, and this teacher that was unknown to me, he said, "Now, with regard to these Buddhists, you've got to wonder whether it's really a religion, because they're idol worshippers." And I said, "I don't think that's true." And he said, "Oh, no, look," he said, "they're idol worshippers." He said, "Have you ever been to a Buddhist country?" And I was only 16 then, and I hadn't been to a Buddhist country at that time, so I had to say no. He said, "Oh, well, I have, and I've seen them. They're down there bowing down to these idols." And that was his impression. Because he didn't know that the image, the Buddha image that we prostrate ourselves to, is simply there as a reminder of the qualities of the Buddha, the qualities of the Dharma that he taught, and the qualities of the senior monks, the enlightened monks who followed in his footsteps. We pay tribute to him because he points the way for us to become free from suffering. And prostrating ourselves in front of an image of the Buddha is not idol worship, but simply a mechanism to allow us to recollect the virtues of the Buddha, the virtues of the Dhamma, and the virtues of the Sangha. And so, faith is a power which allows us to start to develop the process of understanding the Dharma. Because when you pay your respects, when we prostrate ourselves, we should do that mindfully. We should do that knowing what we're doing. So we're developing sati, mindfulness, and that's a key to meditation. So when you come and you come to a meeting like this, if you're a Buddhist, or you go to a monastery to give food or whatever, paying your respects to the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha by prostrating yourself in front of a Buddha image is your first opportunity to have a break from the time when you're a householder making the food or preparing to come to the monastery or whatever it is that you were doing before, the driving here. It allows you to make that break. It gives you the opportunity to then switch into practice mode, if you like, if you're not already in that mode. So you now say, okay, well, as I prostrate, I'm now going to focus my attention on the qualities of the Buddha, the qualities of the Dhamma, the qualities of the Sangha. So the prostration then serves more than one purpose. It not just reinforces faith, but faith now starts to generate some mindfulness, which then you can apply both at the time that you're at the monastery and, of course, during the day. And faith itself helps to combat doubt. If you're going to develop meditation, it's important that your mind is not filled with doubt. This can come about through for many reasons. One, you don't have a very good teacher, or no teacher at all. Two, you read in books what you expect, and an expectation is set of what your meditation is going to be like. And then when your meditation doesn't match what you read in books, then you start to develop doubt. If you develop doubt, your mind will wander. And so it won't become calm. And if it doesn't become calm, it won't be able to develop insight. It won't be able to develop wisdom. So it's important that we overcome doubt. And one of the ways, one of the more obvious ways, is through having faith. Later on, we can overcome doubt by having strong concentration. Because doubt itself is a hindrance to strong concentration. But if we eliminate doubt, use faith as a tool, as a power, then we can develop the basis for good meditation. Effort is another power, wirya in Pali. And I've been through what right effort means several times, but it just means very quickly, it just means promoting the good qualities that you have, the wholesome qualities that you have in your personality, developing new wholesome and good qualities, abandoning the unwholesome qualities that you have, and refraining from taking on new unwholesome qualities, unwholesome personality traits. But effort, that's what the subtle meaning of effort is, but obviously if you're going to practice meditation, then you have to make some effort to get off your, or switch off your TV, and you have to make a physical effort and a mental effort. So you have to get yourself in the right frame of mind to practice. And as a layperson, that's not always so easy, because you've got lots of distractions through family, work, rest, you know, sport, whatever it might be. And so to overcome those distractions requires effort. Physical effort to put yourself in an environment which is more conducive to meditation, and mental effort in a sense that you need to try to develop mindfulness. And that's not easy, especially when you start meditating, because the mind wants to drift off all over the place, and you have to put in some effort to bring it back to its meditation subject. And if you don't put in the effort, it's like anything else. You won't achieve any results. You have to put in effort to train the mind. And that means physical effort as well as mental effort. But if you do put in the effort and you start to practice meditation, then given that it's built on faith, some of the other qualities which are more associated with actual meditation itself, like mindfulness and concentration and wisdom, become or start to develop and become much easier to practice. Mindfulness is the next power, the third one. And mindfulness, or sati in Pali, is a really key component of practicing meditation, and therefore a key component of understanding the Dharma, and therefore a key component in becoming free from suffering. All the components are key components in some ways, but mindfulness, if you're not mindful of your thoughts, not mindful of your speech, not mindful of your bodily actions, then it's very difficult to progress in your development, because mindfulness is there to help train the mind. Because at the moment, we have a mind that goes out looking for all sorts of sensual pleasure. We send it out all over the place, through the senses, through the eyes. We look for things to occupy us. We listen for sounds to occupy us, tastes, smells, touches. And then when we can't find anything in the physical world that comes to us through our senses, then we go and imagine things. We make things up. We remember things and dwell in the past. And this is because the drivers which drive our normal mind are all focused on, or all driven by, desire for sensual pleasure, or desire for experiences to last for a long time, or desire for some experiences like suffering, pain in the legs when you're sitting, desire for that pain to stop. So we have a predisposition to have a mind which is naughty, a mind which doesn't, it's unruly, it doesn't like being contained. And that's because for lifetime after lifetime, it's been able to get away with that. That's its normal, that's its modus operandi. That's not the normal way it operates. So when mindfulness comes along and we start to train the mind, mindfulness becomes like the tether that tethers the untrained dog to the post. And when the mind starts to realize that it's under control, it fights back. It's almost like you have two personalities, the one that wants to practice meditation and the one that doesn't. And if you, well, when you start practicing meditation, you soon realize that actually the mind is not that, you say, oh, this is my body, this is my mind. But if it's your mind, tell it to stop drifting. Tell it just to stay on the meditation subject and see how you go. It doesn't listen. So now some facts should start dawning on you. Hang on a minute. How come I can't control my mind? How come I need a tool like mindfulness? What is going on? And mindfulness is what you need in order to be able to develop concentration, which slows the mind down. And that's the next power. The power of samadhi. The power of being, of tranquility, of concentration, stillness. And mindfulness helps you get there. Some people don't need a lot of mindfulness in order to be able to become concentrated. That's their personality. I knew someone, or I've known people like that, where they can become really concentrated almost at the drop of a hat. But they're not necessarily all that mindful. It's just that that's their karma. They can just almost turn a switch. Of course, a really skilled meditator can turn a switch and become really concentrated if that's their personality also. But generally speaking, for most of us, we develop some mindfulness first. Because we're not all blessed with that ability to be able to easily concentrate. The downside of having the personality that is easily concentrated is that a lot of people get attached to that state of concentration, of tranquility, and they find it extremely difficult to actually turn off and start to develop insight meditation, because they're quite happy just to sit in meditation and just be tranquil for the whole of the time, and that's it. They don't want to investigate and look at the nature of body and mind. So mindfulness is really, really important if we're to get the balance right of developing our mental faculties. Samadhi, as I said, is tranquility. That's the fourth of the five bala. And samadhi comes in different types. When we practice in the beginning, we start in what is called kanika samadhi, or it's really just a normal state of mind, but a state of mind when we've decided to try and practice meditation and we have all things going on, but we are trying and we're developing mindfulness and we bring the mind back to the meditation subject, it drifts off again, we bring it back again, drifts off, bring it back, and we go through this process of training the mind. As we develop and become a little bit more skillful, we become concentrated on our meditation subject. And as I've said previously, that there are lots of different meditation subjects. But the process that we go through when we develop these is very similar for each meditation subject. The results can be slightly different or somewhat different, and one's personality also affects outcomes. But generally speaking, next you become concentrated, a single focus on your meditation subject to the exclusion of all other sensory objects. So all you can feel, if you're practicing anapanasati or watching mindfulness of the breath, you feel the breath come in and go out. Or sometimes what can happen is you can see some kind of vision or some kind of representation of the breath going in or out. And then that becomes the focus of your attention. But let's say you just stick with a feeling of the breath. Wherever the breath comes in and wherever the breath goes out, when it's a long breath, you know it's a long breath. When it's a short breath, you know it's a short breath. And you watch it, and the mind then takes that as its object, and you become still. The mind becomes focused simply on that one object. That's upacara samadhi. When the mind becomes concentrated in that way, and you have the right balance of mindfulness, then that meditation subject will disappear in a flash, by itself. If you have too little mindfulness, it'll disappear because you go back to the state that you were previously, and you've lost your concentration, and the mind starts drifting. If you have too much mindfulness, then the mind won't become concentrated, and you have to learn how to just turn mindfulness down a little bit. But if you just go through normally through the process, and especially when you're developing meditation to start with, then that process is automatic, in the sense that if you keep your concentration focused on your meditation subject, it will just disappear. And then the meditation object and the one who knows the meditation object become one and the same. Now this is a little bit contentious in some ways, because you might get scholars who say that the text doesn't talk about that kind of experience. And I'm quite happy for them to believe that. But if you actually practice and don't just rely on what you read in books, then you'll actually see that what I've just explained is actually what happens. And then one of two things will occur, depending as to how you approached your meditation subject, whether you were just simply watching it, as mostly we do when we're beginners. Then when the mind becomes fully concentrated, it goes into a deep state where all sensory objects as we know them all disappear. Even the meditation subject. You don't hear things, you don't see things. And you move into what is almost a world of its own. Ntama Chante and many of the Thai Ajahns used to refer to this as the state of the Bhavanga. But you'll hardly find that in the scriptures. You can read through the Pali text, the Pali canon, and you'll find very few references to the Bhavanga. But in practice, if you practice meditation and get to that stage, you'll see that that's exactly what happens. You get to a stage where you shut off from the outside world. It's you. But if you've just been watching the meditation subject, then and haven't been investigating the meditation subject, so you've simply been gazing at it, staring at it, if you like, just simply observing it, then all sorts of things can happen when you get into this state of Bhavanga. You can have all sorts of visions It's almost like you have, there's an internal self. Sometimes you can even see yourself in these things, and it's almost like daydreaming. You can meet people, you can do all sorts of anything that you could think of as possible. You can also see scary things if you're that way inclined. This is why it's important to, at this stage, to have a teacher who's actually been through this process and can help you. Because if you do get scared, and there are things which can happen to make you that way, because some of the things which you fear in life, for example, someone who has a phobia for spiders, arachnophobia, they might see a big spider in the state and become really scared. And that's possible. It's also possible that none of that will occur, and that you simply drift into a state of peacefulness. You drift into a place of joy, of happiness, or complete stillness, which is beyond stillness, which is beyond happiness, beyond joy. And when you get to this state, you're really at what Tenachan Tet used to call a singularity. This is one-pointedness. This is oneness. This is emptiness, if you like. Empty of external stimuli. So the mind is totally one-pointed. Its only object is itself. And mindfulness, if you become experienced at this, mindfulness will develop a little bit, but it's not that strong in this state. But it will return when you come out of it. If, on the other hand, when you were looking at your meditation subject before you became concentrated, if at that stage you were looking at the meditation subject, say the breath, as being impermanent, arising and passing away, or as not self, simply being an element, the breath, the air coming in, touching the earth element, simply a natural process, devoid of self. Or if you see it as being suffering, if you see it as any of those three things, of permanent suffering or not self, then you, generally speaking, have a slightly different experience. Your mind becomes still. Still, the object disappears, and the mind and the object fuse and become one. So the object of the mind is the mind itself. Then there develops an awareness which is just simply awareness of awareness. It's just stillness. It's a one. There is no two. There is no duality. The one who knows and that which it knew, they've become one and the same. And that state can last for 1, 2, 3 hours. Generally not long, much longer than that in most cases. And it's there because your mind wants to rest. And that's apana samadhi. And then the mind will come out of that. When it comes out of that, it drops back into upajara samadhi. But this time, it's a different form of upajara samadhi. In fact, some books would say that you drop back into the first kind of samadhi, kanika samadhi, because at this stage, all the six senses are now open to you. But again, practically, that's not what happens. Practically what happens is you drop back into upajara samadhi, but you don't drop back into a state where you're only concentrated on one object. You drop into a state where you can see all the senses arising and passing away. And the more often that you do it, the clearer the vision becomes. And when you're in this state, when you've withdrawn from strong concentration, this is when you can develop wisdom, insight. And for those with the inclination, it's also when you can develop psychic powers. But that's another thing, and not really to be lauded as something to seek after. So the final power is the power of wisdom. So now we've taken faith to help us develop our effort, put in the effort, to help us develop our mindfulness, to help develop concentration, so that we can now apply all these things to insight. So we now take our meditation subject, or just look at worldly dhammas, what's going on with this body and mind, and see whether we look at the body, whether we look at aspects of the mind, whether it's feeling, whether it's thought process, whether it's consciousness, we see them as being impermanent. We see them as being suffering. We see them, all these things, four elements, come together, coalesce, form this body, then disperse when we die. Or, and during the process of our lives, they continually churn, we continually churn through elements. So they're not ours, they don't belong to us. But we take ownership of them through the delusion which occurs within our mind. But it's that sharp mindfulness and concentration which allows wisdom to see through the delusion which is there in our normal waking state. And when we apply that wisdom and see things as being impermanent, suffering, and not self, that's when we can start to look at becoming free from suffering. All the other stages, all up to this stage, are all preliminary steps. Even if you have strong samadhi, strong concentration, great depths of tranquility, able to practice jhana through form, the form jhana and the formless jhanas, you're still caught in the wheel of life. You still haven't escaped samsara. So all the things that I've spoken about are all logia dhamma. They're all worldly. They all have a beginning and an end. But if you can develop the mind to the state where you can start to investigate and use wisdom, then you have a chance of actually stepping on the path to freedom from suffering. And from a Buddhist perspective, that's what the aim of meditation is. So when you come and you prostrate before the Buddha, recollecting the qualities of the Buddha, you know he went down this path. And it's because of him being the forerunner of all enlightened beings in this Buddhist era that we know that the path that I've just outlined to you works. And it's the path that we should all try and practice as Buddhists. And if we do, then we all stand a chance of reaching enlightenment. And even if we don't get there, we'll make more good karma rather than bad karma. And that can only bode well for us, both in this life and in future lives. That's it for me. Air one. So let's do some meditation. So, like I said, pick your meditation subject and don't keep chopping and changing your meditation subject. If you find one thing doesn't work, at least give it a go, put in some effort. And if it doesn't work after a while, then by all means try something else. Or better still, find someone who can help you, who can perhaps give you some ideas as to what better subjects there would be to suit your personality. Not so easy to do in the West. But take your meditation subject. Make it clear in your mind. Don't just take it in some half-hearted way. Because now when you're starting, it should be clear. Because this is your baseline. So when the mind drifts, you know, fine, yes, now I know it's drifted. And bring it back. Just gently bring it back. Don't have any expectations that you're going to achieve this or achieve that or achieve the other. Just simply bring the mind back on subject. And if you keep training the mind in this way, its stubbornness, its resistance will eventually yield. And your mind will become one-pointed. And then, when you get to that stage, as I said, you've really started. You've got to the stage where you can really learn about the Dhamma. just ignore that. Finishing our meditation now. Just come around in your own time. There's no rush. It's tempting to want to stay in peace and calm. But even that is impermanent. Just take your time. Feel comfortable. Stay relaxed. Some deeper breaths. Back straight. Slowly open your eyes. So, not that I expect any, based on past experiences, but I'll ask if there are any questions. I'm quite happy to take on board questions.
You always say you would subject. What is it exactly that you mean?
Sorry?
You say, go to your Dharma subject.
Or your meditation subject.
Meditation subject, yeah.
So, your meditation subject is, it could be a mindfulness of breathing, it could be mindfulness of death, it could be mindfulness of the unattractiveness of the body, it could be mindfulness of feelings that are rising and passing away. There are a whole range of meditation subjects. But you have to find one which, at least one, that is you feel comfortable with. And if you read books and try and find a meditation subject, you may be successful, but you may not be. That's why most teachers teach Anapanasati, because it works for almost all personality types. And it doesn't matter which meditation subject you choose, the process that you go through in terms of how the mind works will be very, very similar. So you go through Kanika Samadhi, Upachara Samadhi, Apana Samadhi, and come out again when you develop your meditation to that level. But the experiences that you have along the way will flavour those stages or flavour that process. If you practice more investigation when you're going into a state of strong concentration, apana samadhi, then you tend to have a little bit more mindfulness. And when you come out of that state, that mindfulness returns. But in that state, mindfulness is not really what you would call mindfulness. It's just a basic awareness which is hard to describe. But that similar sort of thing will happen regardless of the meditation subject that you choose. But in some cases, when you get into those stages, you can see things like what we call nimittas or visions or signs. They don't have to be a vision, but they could even be a smell. And that could be also conditioned by what your meditation subject is, along with what your personality is. And sometimes they're good and sometimes they're not so good. But the basic process is very similar. That's why it's useful if you've got someone who can help guide you through that process, because you know it does. Each person's got their own idiosyncrasies, and it's useful to be able to understand your idiosyncrasies so that you don't get lost along the way. Does that answer your question?
So when you're not with the subject, you pick and you focus on it, is working. Is it of how much you're able to bring yourself when the mind drifts to the subject?
Yes, if you're finding that after a few weeks, if you practice regularly, say an hour a day, let's just take that as an example, and after 2 or 3 weeks, you find that your mind is still drifting, still not comfortable, then there's a couple of things that you can do besides change your meditation subject. You might also find that perhaps sitting is not so good for you, that walking may be better. So it could be posture. But it could also be that your meditation subject is not one which is conducive to your personality. Let me also qualify that by saying or explaining this. People who have a lot of lust or a lot of greed, a good meditation subject for them is looking at the loathsomeness of the body, seeing the body decay and see it in various stages of death, whether it's being blue and bloated or eaten by maggots or eaten by vultures or a skeleton at the side of the road or something like that, because it immediately counteracts lust. It goes, takes it on head on, and that's a good thing to do. But what happens is, it's like I said, there's almost like there's two of you. It's almost like there's the you that wants to meditate and there's the you that doesn't. And when you get that head on going, the usual you says, oh, this isn't working. You know, I don't want to do this. So there's also that where you've got to stick in it. You know, because it's like putting a plant in the garden, you know. If you dig a hole and then think, oh, no, I don't want it there, and then go around and dig a hole somewhere else, you end up with lots of holes, but you haven't got your plant where you want it. And meditation subjects can't be swapped and changed around like that. You have to give them a go. But it's also, I gave a talk, was it last week or week before, about having a Kalyana Mitta, who's a friend or a guide. And if you're just starting out in meditation, it's very useful to have someone who's a bit more advanced than you that can give you a bit of guidance when it comes to doing those sorts of things. But that's one of the problems of living in the West, that there are so few people that you can turn to that can actually help you through that process. Whereas if you're living in Thailand, like I did for years, and you can go and see lots of different teachers and find one that suits your personality as well.
So which are some of these most popular subjects that you focus? I mean, I think breathing works for me. It's like that when I keep going to it and
yeah, well, that's fine. It
seems to work.
And what some people do, if they like breathing but they're still having a problem with it, is that they associate it with what we would call a mantra, if you like, a parikama, a word. Yeah. So even some people count the breath. So they count it coming in, one, going out, two, three, and they watch whether the breath is long or short. Or sometimes they use like Buddha, which is the recollection of the Buddha, the one who knows. Because the one who knows works, and we're highly taught in Thailand, because when you practice meditation and you get to the stage where you have a one-pointedness, where the meditation subject is in focus, there are two things there. There's still duality. There's the one that knows, and there's that which is known, the object. And so Buddha is an expression of a word which refers to the one who knows. And what you need to get to is the one who knows. The value is getting to the one who knows rather than your meditation subject. Your meditation subject is just a means to an end. So When you get to the one who knows, then there's a singularity, there's a oneness, there's an emptiness. It's just, like I said, a singularity. There's nothing, there's no object. It's the knower and the object are the one and the same. And that's the state that you want to get to. So that's why people use the Parikama Bhutto with the breath, because what they really want to do is get away from the breath and get to that point of Bhutto. Normally what happens is if you do that and associate a Parikama or a mantra with the breath, is that the Parikama goes first. So you lose that, you know, you stop doing that and you're left with the breath. And then eventually the breath gets so fine, even that disappears too.
Yeah.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah,
thank you. Good, two good questions. Okay. It must be over to the Master of Ceremonies to get this.
Okay, let's chant the blessing of sharing and aspiration. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all the virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease and all harmful states of mind until I realize Nirvana. In every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind, with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge, unsurpassed is the protection of the Dharma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all ladies, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.